shooting at the planes and so forth. And when I went up there, I was 16 years old, not very smart. So on deck there was a box, they call it a potato box. I don't know why, maybe they store potatoes there. But anyway, I got on top of this box and I was watching what was going on. And I looked to the back of the ship aft, and the captain was zigzagging the ship to make a...
Sure, for the submarines.
Submarine. Yeah. So I'm looking back there, and there's a torpedo right behind, about 20, 30 yards off the stern of our ship.
Holy cow.
The Germans had shot.
I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes, a podcast dedicated to honoring the brave men and women who allow us to enjoy the greatest privilege in the world, freedom. Each Tuesday, I'll sit down with an American military hero. We will listen to unedited, authentic stories in their own voices, in their own words. We will hear incredible military stories from some of the greatest heroes to ever walk the face of this earth. And who knows, we may learn a few of their secret life lessons along the way. Although none of us can begin to imagine what they've seen, heard, and experienced, during our time together, I'll do my very best to take us all for a walk among heroes. Here we go. I'm Jeff Wells, and you're listening to Walk Among Heroes podcast episode 36, featuring Mr. George Koch of the United States Merchant Marines. And I believe Mr. Koch is our first ever guest from the Merchant Marines, and they played an absolutely pivotal role in World War II. Mr. Koch had a particularly interesting mission during the war. He actually was part of a convoy that ran supplies from the United States to Murmansk, which is a port in Russia. And they called that particular route the Murmansk Run. And it was absolutely treacherous for many different reasons. If you remember, during the war, the United States was involved in what was called the Lend-Lease Program, and that is where we were using our manufacturing might to produce vehicles, weapons, tanks, sending over food and every other type of supply you could think of. We were sending those supplies to all of our allies, especially Great Britain. You know, they had expended many of their natural resources fighting the war to that point, and then to Russia as well, who was knee-deep in battling the Germans. And so as we were producing these weapons and vehicles and things, it was very, very difficult to transport them to Russia. Obviously, the Pacific side of the world was blockaded by the Japanese. We were fighting them in that theater. And then to the west, Germany had blockaded many of the seas to the west. So one of the only supply routes that could actually reach Russia went north through the Arctic, around Norway, which, by the way, was a German-controlled territory, and further north all the way to the port of Murmansk, which was somewhat accessible. But to get there, not only did one have to travel through German-occupied waters, it was occupied by their U-boats, their submarines, their navy, but also had to brave the treacherous, treacherous conditions, which basically like traveling through the North Pole, where you have ice and snow and frozen water year-round. So very difficult. So Mr. Koch, at age 16, actually made that run. He joined the Merchant Marines while he was basically a sophomore in high school, and that was his first mission, his first run with the Merchant Marines. And the Merchant Marines were it was sort of like an extended branch of the military. So in World War II, many of the ships were outfitted with minimal protection, minimal guns, and then were utilized to not only transport supplies in Mr. Koch's case, but also many of those ships were involved in the Normandy landings, transporting troops, transporting supplies from Europe to the U.S., and so on and so forth. Mr. Koch grew up in New York. At age 16, as I mentioned, he joined the Merchant Marines. His first ship that he ever boarded was the Eloy L. Farrell, SS Eloy L. Farrell, which ultimately ended up making that run on the Murmansk Run. And the first part of that journey was from across the North Atlantic to Scotland. And then they stopped in Scotland for a bit, refueled, and then made the run north. On the run north through hostile territory, they were nearly shot with a torpedo. And you'll hear the story that Mr. Koch tells about when that poor torpedo was shot at them and how close they were to being killed, and how some of the other boats that were part of his convoy didn't fare as well as he did. So just an amazing story. Obviously, we have not published a podcast for quite some time. And the reason being is we've been focused on developing a series of World War II experiences, trips, tours, whatever you want to call them. And we've been focused on June 2023 and June 2024. We put together a series of Normandy trips where we are allowing people to travel with us to Normandy with several of our World War II veterans to experience what it's really like. And those trips will take place. We've developed four different trips, basically each week of June 2023, which is coming up on us pretty quickly. And then we're going to do the same thing for June 2024. June 2023, this is our 79th anniversary of D-Day, which will be huge. And then obviously next year in 2024 will be the 80th anniversary of D-Day, which will be massive. They're expecting millions of people to descend upon Normandy. And it'll probably be the last time that World War II veterans are physically able to visit Normandy during the commemoration. So just an amazing time. And we wanted to develop a program to try to allow more people to experience Normandy. We're also going to be developing trips to other World War II sites across the world. We've talked about a trip to Arnhem. We've talked about trips to Italy and some other places where Belgium, other places where famous World War II battles were fought. But this is all based on your feedback. And we took two trips last year to Normandy, and they were both just amazing. And everybody that attended had just a wonderful time. And we stay at a chateau that was built in the 11th century, originally inhabited by the Vikings, still is in the same family today. And it's truly a castle, a chateau of epic proportions. And it's just an amazing, amazing experience all around. All the proceeds that are raised will donate to Wish for Our Heroes to help military families and veterans with basic needs. So food, shelter, transportation, child needs, medical expenses. You can learn more about Wish for Our Heroes at wishforourheroes.org. And if you're interested in any of these experiences, you can just visit our website, which is walkamongheroes.org. If you want to go straight to the experiences page, it's walkamongheroes.org/experiences and take a look at those. And there's a discount, obviously, for anybody that is part of the Walk Among Heroes family. So if you're interested, just send us an email or fill out that link on the website, and we can send you more information about the trips. But we're preparing for June 2023 and 2024. But June 2023 is coming up on us quickly. Still have a few slots available for each of the weeks. So when you get a chance, check it out, www.walkamongheroes.org/experiences. Without further ado, enjoy episode 36 featuring Mr. George Koch.
When I was 15 years old, I kind of lied about my age, and I went to work at a steel plant. And while I was working there, I was working with some of these fellows that were a little older than I was, because I was only 15. And some of them were getting drafted, and some of them were signing up and going into the service. So patriotism was very high at that time, during 1943, 1944. So my two brother-in-laws were in the service already, and I wanted to join the service. I turned 17 in January 3rd, 1944.
Okay.
I finished my sophomore year in high school.
Sure.
And I could join the Merchant Marines at 16. So I joined the Merchant Marines at 16.
And that was right in the thick of the war.
That was June of 1944.
Okay.
Yeah, that was just before Normandy.
Yeah, that was right in the thick of the...
Okay, I went to Sheep's Head Bay in Brooklyn, New York for my boot camp. Finished that, I went to a few weeks of going to fireman school. I'd come out of there as a second-class fireman. I went to the Union Hall, and they sent me to Pier 61 in New York City, Brooklyn.
Okay.
And put me on a Liberty ship.
Okay.
The USS Eloy El Faro. And we weren't told exactly where we were going, but we were going in a convoy. So our ship got loaded, and we went out to the joined a convoy, and we went to Scotland, Glasgow, Scotland.
Okay.
And we took on a few supplies. And we got in another convoy, which was made up mostly of British warships.
Sure.
And we left Scotland and headed north into the North Atlantic. And the Germans had taken over Norway by this time, and they had air force bases, air bases, and naval bases in Norway. Of course, when we had our convoy, we were going right past Norway.
Right.
So we were attacked at when we were up in that area. We were attacked by planes and submarines. General quarters was called. I was in the boiler room, but I wanted to go on top. We were trained in boot camp to man the 20-millimeter guns in case the armed guard, which were Navy personnel on our ships,
right,
in case they were wounded or killed or anything. So I went topside to see if there was any place I could be of any help. Well, the armed guard had everything under control. They were shooting at the planes and so forth. And when I went up there, I was 16 years old, not very smart. So on deck there was a box, they call it a potato box. I don't know why, maybe they stored potatoes there. But I got on top of this box and I was watching what was going on. And I looked to the back of the ship aft, and the captain was zigzagging the ship to make a...
Sure, for the submarines.
Submarine.
Yeah.
So I'm looking back there, and there's a torpedo right behind about 20, 30 yards off the stern of our ship.
Holy cow. The
Germans had shot. So they missed us, thank goodness. So we didn't have any casualties, thank goodness. And that was the only attack we had at that
And you
time.
Realized at that point that was a torpedo.
Yeah.
What did you were like, oh,
whoa.
Crap.
Yeah. And on the Liberty ship, there's only about a half inch of steel
right.
between you and the water.
So your ship, on the Liberty ship, it's literally just supplies. So you have supplies, you have minimal guns, the 20-millimeter.
Yeah, we had 20-millimeter. They said we had a 5-inch gun, but I don't remember seeing a 5-inch gun on our ship. There was one.
20-millimeter is enough to try to keep the planes away.
Keep the planes,
protect yourself.
Yeah. So, okay. So we made it to Murmansk, and we got into the harbor and stopped. And on our ship, we had locomotives, steam locomotives, and coal cars we took to Russia. And when we got there, we unloaded in our hold. We had foodstuffs, ammunition, and I don't know what all in our hold. And we unloaded that. And when we were in dock at the dock, we were allowed to go ashore. And Murmansk was completely bombed out. Everything was destroyed.
Devastated.
That I could see. And very few buildings stood. I mean, if there was any buildings at all, most of them didn't have roofs. The roads were made out of mud. They were all destroyed. They had built wooden sidewalks for people to walk on. And I went ashore one time with a Polish fellow. He was of Polish descent, and he spoke Polish. And we happened to meet three older women, and one of the women was able to talk to my friend who spoke Polish. And we asked, where are the children? And all they would say is, they are in a safe place. And we asked, where are the women? And they told us that the wives of the soldiers go with their husbands to the front lines in Russia.
Wow.
Yeah, we were surprised to hear that. So, and we asked, where are the young girls? And they said, they are in a safe place also. So that's all they would say about them. They wouldn't. And we weren't allowed to go outside the city. We were allowed to go in the city, but we weren't allowed to travel outside the city. And so these women we were talking to said, do you enjoy music? So we said, sure, yes. So they took us to a building that had been an auditorium or a theater, and there was a stage, and we had wooden benches that we sat on. There was no curtains or anything at the stage, but there was an orchestra there. And they were playing semi-classical Russian music.
I'll be darned.
Now, when I went, when I was in the U.S. and I went to the USOs and so forth, we used to listen to music.
Sure.
And I was familiar with one of the songs that they were playing, and these women were very surprised that an American recognized and knew some of the music. Russian music. So that was one experience that we had there. So,
by the way, you're probably one of very, very few people that ever set, Americans that ever set foot on Russian soil during
probably,
World War II.
Probably, yeah. There was a few. Merchant Marines that took supplies, lend-lease supplies to Russia, and we had good relations with the soldiers. The soldiers unloaded the ship.
Yeah.
They, you know, you in the U.S. you had civilians,
right.
But in Russia it was all soldiers that unloaded the ships. And we had good relations with them. I traded cigarettes for this, that, and the next thing. And we couldn't really talk, but we could sign language more or less. So we unloaded, and then we went out and got in a convoy again to return to the States. We got in the convoy, and we were. Still in the Arctic, and one incident that I tell is one night around Christmas time. This was by this time, because our ship had left New York. I think it was in September or October. Now we went to Glasgow. Now we went to Murmansk, and by this time we were on our way back home, and it was around Christmas time. I went up on deck, and it was pitch black. Of course, you couldn't have a lighter. You couldn't even smoke a cigarette up on deck for fear that you might
be spotted.
Get spotted, right. So I was standing there up on deck, and all of a sudden, the whole sky turned white. Then it turned green. Then it turned yellow. The northern lights. It was beautiful. Way up north, you could see it. I mean, it was fantastic. And I said, this is the northern lights celebrating Jesus' birthday.
Yeah. Amazing. Wow. What? And again, you're probably one of very few people that have ever seen it like that, because you were so far north.
Yes, yeah.
You were so far north. Wow.
Yeah, it was amazing, yeah. So, okay, we, after a few days, we hit a storm. We were in a storm. We were rolling and tossing and turning. A Liberty ship is about 410 foot long.
Okay.
About 56 foot beam. And we were rolling over 45 degrees. when we took a ballast down in Murmansk, they loaded our ballast with manganese ore, and our ballast shifted in this storm, so we were kind of tipped over to one side. And they say salt water doesn't freeze. I want to tell you something different. Salt water freezes.
That part of the world, that ocean there, is some of the most brutal territory.
Yes.
I mean, you can see on, if you ever watch that show where they go in Alaska, if the king crab, you know, that sort of thing, you were much farther north than that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so that was a picture of the ice.
That's really amazing.
And the deck, I was a wiper in the boiler room, but the deck hands had to go up on deck when it was iced like this.
Yeah.
It was so heavy topside that it was making the ship top heavy. So they had to go up there and chip the ice off. So
you're wet, cold, windy, all over everything.
Yes.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
It was terrible.
And you know, did you know when you, I mean, after you made the first trip, you probably knew what you were in for, but on that first trip, did you know where you were going and all that?
No. When I went aboard the ship, I had no idea where we were going until we got out to sea. When we left New York, after we got out to sea, then they said, we're going to Glasgow, then we're going to Murmansk Flip. I didn't have any idea what the Murmansk run was at that time. That was the most dangerous run of the whole war.
Yes, it was.
There's a picture of me on the cover of this magazine.
Oh, my gosh. See? That is so cool. Does the Merchant Marine Veterans Association, do they issue this like every year?
Or is no, that comes out every 3 months.
That's really neat.
And it's nationwide.
Sure. So. You know, it's so interesting because the Merchant Marines, a lot of people don't know or understand.
They don't even know anything about them.
And the role that they, particularly in World War II, whether it's the Normandy landings or, you know, there were, I don't know how many, but there were many, many Merchant Marine vessels Normandy landings, too.
Yes.
Any significant amphibious operation that we did throughout the war, the Merchant Marines were heavily involved.
Yes.
Not many people know that.
They supplied the whole war. Who were at war with all the equipment they needed and food and everything else that they needed in these ports and so forth.
And that was the primary, so the Murmansk run, that was the primary means of getting supplies over to Russia, right? Yes. I mean, that was really the only way.
Yes, they
because Europe was blockaded to the west, and then you had Japan to the east.
Yeah, so there's no way they couldn't use the Pacific run. No, so Murmansk from Scotland and Iceland, Greenland to Russia was the only way. So one thing. We weren't attacked that much. We were just attacked that one time. Sure. Now, I read later, 6 months or a year later after the war was ended, that Russia was running out of fuel. So they Germany was running out of fuel, and also they were involved in Normandy. So that's, I think, I'm not sure, but I'm adding two and two and four because we weren't attacked more than we were because of the lower, they were low
They just
on
didn't
fuel,
have the supplies.
And they were supplying
the Trying to
France.
Fuel the effort in.
So I think that's why we weren't attacked more than we were. Oh, one... One other thing that after we were attacked, I was in the boiler room working, of course, and the British knew there were submarines around. So they were coming around our ship they must have felt that the submarines were near. So they were around our ship and they were dropping depth charges right near our ship. Now, it was like putting a bucket on your head and hitting it with a hammer. That's the way it sounded in the boiler room.
Yeah, so you were down in the boiler room.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
I bet that scared the heck out of you, too.
Yeah. At first, I thought we were being attacked when we first heard this bombs going off, you might say. But they were the depth charges. So that was another scary thing.
So you made your first run in early 1944.
1944.
How long would one run? Say you leave the U.S. on
September,
day one.
And I didn't get back until January.
Wow. So 3 months, roughly, per run.
September, October, November.
More than four months. September, October, November. Yeah, so more
and
than
I
4 months.
They say that merchant marines were overpaid. I earned less than $1,000.
So you went from New York to Scotland, and then Scotland is where they did you load everything in the U.S. or was that loaded
in
the
U.S.?
Okay,
yes.
So all the stuff came from the lend lease program.
We got a few supplies in, right. And probably foodstuffs, and
right.
Fuel, and yeah. But that was all we got in Scotland.
So how many runs did you make over there?
One.
One, yeah.
After I got back from Murmansk. When I was in the boiler room, I got friendly with the third engineer, and he was tutoring me, and I was learning, taking everything I could learn to be an engineer, and I wanted to go back to New York City where I was able to take the examination. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to go back to New York City and take the examination to become a third engineer. Well, our ship was, you might say, damaged because we were...
Sure, limping.
We lost our convoy. We were making about 3 knots, but we did get back to Portland, Maine. We didn't go back to New York City. We got back to Portland, Maine, and they paid me off, so I went home.
Gotcha.
I had turned 17 by this. I think I got off the ship January 12th. I turned 17 January 3rd.
Wow, okay.
So when I got home, I was home for a while. That's when I met.
That's when we started going together.
I knew her from the neighbor. My sister lived two or three doors from where she lived.
And he was just a fellow in the neighborhood. That's how I knew him. I mean,
sure.
A little bit, you know.
Sure.
In fact, he kind of ran around with my brother. And
yeah.
I kind of knew him.
So when I got back home from the Merchant Marines, I started dating her. So after, I think in June, I went and I joined the Navy.
Wow.
So I joined the Navy when I was 17. And when I joined the Navy, I signed up for the duration of the war in 6 months. That's what my...
Commitment was.
Commitment was. The duration of the war in 6 months. So I took another boot camp in Sampson, New York. And I took another boot camp. When I got into boot camp, because I had served in the Merchant Marines, they made me an acting petty officer. And I was like a drill instructor.
Sure.
You know, I'm 17 years old, and these guys that were drafted are 18, 19, 20,
That's
21.
Crazy.
And I'm putting them through the... But I was in good shape then. When I got back out of the Merchant Marines, I was about 6 foot tall, 185
wow.
pounds, and really in good shape.
Sure.
So nobody messed with me.
Right.
So,
well, when you're that age, you can run through a wall too, and yeah, it doesn't bother you.
Yeah. So that was about my experience.
And that was, so you were probably, the war ended probably before you had to go.
When I got out of boot camp, the war ended.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I got out of boot camp and I went to, that was in New York State, and they sent me to Rhode Island, and they went to gunnery school.
Okay.
So in the Navy, I went to gunnery school. And they were building my ship, the ship that I was going on, in Boston.
Okay.
So.
What kind of a ship?
Heavy cruiser.
Okay.
CA-122, heavy cruiser.
Okay.
USS Oregon City.
Okay.
And we were assigned to the ship. And because of the war ending and the servicemen that were on the ship that were being discharged, most of the gunner's mates and seamen and so forth that had experience were getting out.
Yeah.
So, like me, I had training in, as a gunner's mate. They took me and made me in charge of a quad 40 millimeter gun mount. So I had that. That was my job in the Navy.
Interesting. Thank God you didn't have to go over to the Pacific. Yeah,
yes, that's where we thought we were going. Yeah,
that's when he joined. He figured that's where he'd end up in the Pacific.
And so at that point, you were just dating. Two of you were just dating. But you were worried about him at this point because you figured you'd have to have to go over there. And then, thankfully, the bombs were dropped and the war ended. And then after how long after the war ended did it take for you to get married? Did the two of you get married?
Well, he got home in August 46.
Okay.
And we got engaged then.
Okay.
And then we got married in February 47.
Okay.
So we will be married in February 47, 75 years. 75 years.
That is amazing.
It's coming up pretty quick.
Just a few more months. That is amazing.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
I have received several requests for my signature from different people from all over the country, and one from Germany, in fact.
Interesting.
So.
Interesting. Like fan mail.
I thought he'd like to see some of your medals.
Oh, yeah. I'd love to.
Would you?
I'd love to.
Well, here's some of the papers that I've received.
Oh my gosh, this is... Wow, look at that ice.
That what?
The ice on the ice.
Oh. Yeah.
This is amazing. Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, there's...
Did you ever thought you'd, when you were growing up in New York, did you ever think you'd receive fan mail for your autograph?
No. He never thought he would see it even to last year.
That is amazing. And you pronounce your name Coke, right?
Yes,
Coke? Okay.
Coke, like Coca-Cola. Yeah.
So, dear Mr. Coke, hello, my name is Henry. I'm 13 years old and I live in Fitchburg, Wisconsin. I'm very interested in American history, particularly World War II. I heard about how you were a merchant marine during World War II. At first, just want to say thank you so much for your service to our country. I think the merchant marine does not get the credit they deserve. They were an essential piece of the Allied victory. Anyway, thank you so much for your service. I'm currently collecting autographs of World War II veterans and people involved with events during the war. I was wondering, could I please have your autograph? I included a few index cards. If you could sign them for me, that would be awesome. I included a self-addressed stamped envelope for return. I hope you're having a great day, and I wish you the very best. Your friend, Henry.
He knows a little bit about what that's like.
Amazing. But that's so great to see kids.
Yeah.
A kid of his age, 13 years old.
And he knows... how involved the merchant marines were with in the war.
Not many people know.
And they don't. And now, see, finally, they're recognizing the merchant marines.
I know.
The government is recognizing them even.
So how did it come about with your award from Russia? How did that all come about? I've never heard of an American receiving an award from the Russian government.
They have been doing that for a few years.
Okay.
We belong to a local organization of merchant marines, a club more or less, and one of our neighbors was the president of the club, and he was talking to, well, at that time, this Drew DiMatteo, who lives in Cape Coral.
Okay.
He at that time, he was the vice president of our Merchant Marine Veterans Organization, and this Peter, that was the president of our local organization, was talking to Drew, the vice president of the organization, and told him about me being...
Well, actually, I think they were looking for veterans who, especially who had done the Merman's Run at that time because of the danger that was about there, and they wanted to recognize them.
So I think Drew, the vice president of the organization, told or contacted the Russian embassy.
I see.
I got to tell you a little story. We were sitting here like this, and we had our exterminator come in to spray for bugs and so forth. And my cell phone rang, and I'm not too good at hearing, so I put it on speakerphone. And I got this call, and the person had a very thick accent. And I'm trying to hear, and I couldn't understand what they were saying. And just then, the exterminator walked by, and I said, I can't understand this, and I hung up. He said, do you know who that was? I said, no, it was some telemarketer, I think. He said, that was a Russian embassy calling. I said, uh-oh.
Oh,
do you know how to get that phone? I didn't know how to get that back again.
Call back.
So he took the phone and he finally was able to get that number. So I called the number back and I explained who I was. And she wanted to know what ship I was on, what dates were, and you know, all the details of my experience going to Russia. So that's how it started.
How it all came.
But he's Chris. Now,
Chris.
He stood by him, and whenever she would ask a question, he could understand it, but not.
I couldn't understand it, but Chris, the exterminator, he could understand.
So he was like the interpreter.
Yeah.
Your exterminator was the interpreter.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a good story.
Oh, and by the way, when I received the award at the Punta Gorda Punta Gorda Veterans Museum, I told this story about
that's how I started my little
speech, and they got a kind of a kick out of it. And after the ceremony was over, they had refreshments outside.
Sure.
And lo and behold, my exterminator read about it in the paper, and he was there. So that was a surprise to me. So that was very...
Too bad he didn't know it. He would have said, hey,
if I would have known he was there, I would have pointed him out.
Where did the Russian embassy come... Where is the Russian embassy? Are they in...
In Washington.
Washington. So they came here from Washington.
Yeah.
Wow.
Show them your medals. That's, got a couple medals.
I'd love to see them.
Okay. I got them in the drawer.
I'd love to see them.
I'll put them in the dining room.
Okay.
Well, don't bring them here, honey.
I can come in there if you need me to.
No, bring them here.
That's so...
You know, I haven't seen them in here. I haven't paid a whole lot of attention to myself. One thing I was curious about, you showed a picture of that.
Yeah, when I was in Iraq, yeah.
Yes.
So that...
Whatever happens.
No, that's a very special picture to me because that little girl had... Both of her parents were killed in an IED blast. And so an IED is the bombs. You know, the terrorists, they hide these bombs everywhere and they try to wait for the U.S. soldiers to come by. Uh-huh. And then when we come by, they try to kill us. Uh-huh. But what they really end up doing is they end up killing hundreds of their local people. And this little girl had both of her parents killed. And so we used to have certain... We were in Baghdad, Iraq. And so we used to have certain routes that we would go on patrol. And we kind of got to know some of the people along these routes in these different places. And we got to know that little girl. And every time we would come, she would just jump up and down. And we'd bring her candy. And we'd bring her all those sorts of things. And for Christmas, my friends back home would send U.S. gifts. And we'd bring her toys and things like that. And quite frankly, when you're in that environment, the only thing that really brings you any joy are the children. Because the adults hate us. They hate us. Every one of them hates us because they think that you know, we're trying to take over the country and we're really just trying to help them. But they don't know that, you know. And yes. So, but when you see the kids are innocent and they're not yet corrupted. And it brings a joy to you. And so that little girl, you know, whenever I look at my tour over there, we lost a lot of guys, and it was kind of a difficult tour, but that always brings good memories, you know.
Yeah.
So that's what I always use when people ask for pictures from Iraq. I have thousands of pictures, but I always send that picture because it means so much, you know. But
and you're not in contact with her anymore.
No,
you never heard what...
I don't know anything.
She was probably still fairly young when you left. Yeah.
She's probably, at that point, she was probably 3, maybe, or 4. Oh. So now she would be, that was back in 2005, so...
Oh, yeah, that was 16 years ago.
Yeah, she'd be 20 years old now.
Yeah.
But we had other schools that we would visit occasionally, and we would bring things for the children, and, you know, we would... You know, sometimes they paint a picture of the U.S. being the bad guy over there, but we did as much good as we could for the people to try to help them, and certainly the children, because the children they didn't choose to be in that situation.
You're right. Little ones always bring a joy to your life, you know. They do.
And
I can imagine over there it would be all more meaningful.
You know, every day you drive down those streets over there, and first of all, you never know when you're going to get attacked. It happened to us 4 times a day, so we never knew when we were going to get attacked. And then you look on both sides of the road and they're yelling at you, the adults are yelling at you and screaming in Arabic about how much they hate us and, you know, everything else. And of course, we were in our area that we were in was Saddam's old stomping ground, so all of the people in our area were very loyal to Saddam. So, of course, when we came in and we overthrew Saddam, they automatically hated us. And then we also used to bring in the terrorists from Syria. The Al-Qaeda terrorists would come into our area first because they had a lot of friends in our area. So, basically, everybody just hated us, you know, aside from the children. And
let's see, you weren't ever in Afghanistan.
I was not in Afghanistan, just in Iraq. And it was, I was there for 15 months, so a year and, and 3 months. And
it's a long time to be.
They extended us. I know, and they extended us. They originally sent us for a year, but then they kept extending us, you know, a month at a time because they needed more troops. And the one thing about our military today, it's pretty small in terms of manpower. You know, like back in World War II, we grew it and built it, and now we have, you know, we rely very heavily on technology and things, but when you get into a war like that and you need more troops, there's not many to pull from. So we ended up just staying longer.
Just trying to think of how old our great, we have three grandsons, all from that same family, and Jason is, I think all three of them would be older than you, but they all three served in, in the service.
Yeah, yeah.
And that concludes episode 36 with the amazing Mr. George Koch. He just such a well-spoken young man. He is young compared to some of the other World War II veterans that we've interviewed. But he's so well-spoken, and it was so interesting to see his medals. And in the intro, I neglected to mention the fact that he was awarded a Medal of Honor from the Russian government, which is very, very unusual, highly, highly unusual for anybody from the United States to be awarded that medal from the Russian government. And as you heard from his story, he actually set foot in the town of Murmansk on Russian soil during World War II. And he's one of the few Americans that ever set foot on Russian soil during World War II, and probably one of the few Americans that's ever set foot on Russian soil. Obviously, in this day and age, with the Cold War over many, many years, and now the second coming of the Cold War, so to speak, and the whole conflict that's happening today, it's very, very rare to meet anybody that's been to Russia. And the fact that he was there during sort of the height of World War II, when Germany and Russia were at really the height of their battle, and just after we landed in Europe after D-Day and Operation Market Garden and all those sorts of things were happening during that time, it was a very, very crazy time, and just crazy to think that he was literally in Russia meeting and talking to Russian soldiers, talking to the locals, and just a crazy, crazy experience. Of course, he just sort of, you know, laughs it off, says, oh yeah, maybe I was one of few, but it really is a huge deal to think about that at age 16, he was over there experiencing that, and then to hear his story about the Northern Lights and how emotional he was during that time, and hard to really feel the emotion on a podcast episode, but to see it in person was really absolutely amazing. Hope you enjoyed it. We're going to continue to publish these episodes. I have several interviews that I've conducted. We've been focused so heavily on planning these trips. We just haven't published many episodes lately, but we're going to get back on a regular schedule here, and hopefully you enjoy these. And again, we don't have many World War II veterans remaining, so we're going to do the best we possibly can to share their stories, share their lessons with all of you. As mentioned earlier, if you're interested in attending any of the Walk Among Heroes trips, right now to Normandy and then in the future to other places, you can visit walkamongheroes.org and click on the experiences link, or type in www.walkamongheroes.org/experiences. We support Wish for Our Heroes heavily, which is a military charity that assists military families and veterans with basic needs. If you want to learn more about them, you can visit www.wishforourheroes.org. As always, we want to thank all of those service members and veterans, but particularly those active duty service members who are out there around the world in places that we can't even imagine right now, defending our freedom and our way of life. We want to thank all those who came before us, who fought in multiple wars, and all those who are still fighting today. God bless all of you. Thanks to our U.S. Army soldiers, our Navy, our Marine Corps, our Air Force, our Coast Guard, our Space Force. Thanks for all you do. Thanks to all those police, those firefighters that are here stateside protecting all of us, protecting our way of life, our safety, and our freedom. And again, the greatest privilege in the world is freedom. And those that protect it, it's a sacred, difficult, honorable duty. And we want to thank all of you. Until next time, enjoy, be safe, and let's take a walk among heroes.